Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 1st, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And, two segments up for tonight. The first, a little bit off the beaten track for this program, an interview with Evelyn McDonnell, who is a pop culture critic at the Miami Herald and author of a book called Mama Rama, a memoir of sex, kids, and rock and roll. I'm interested in this because, my kid, Ivan, turns 14 months old today, and it's a big change for a guy who's used to being an oddball and outcast to be a figure of authority and responsibility. Since Evelyn McDonnell talks about some of that in this book, I thought it'd be interesting to compare notes. A book just out from Da Capo Press, by the way. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Omar Lizardo, who is a sociologist at Notre Dame, who will be challenging some of the so-called cultural imperialism theory, globalization. He's got a paper called Globalization and Culture, a Sociological Perspective, and he doesn't think it's all a matter of a global hierarchy of culture with the rest of the world being poisoned by American popular material, but he thinks it's a lot more complicated than that. So we will ask him what that's all about, and that will be at the bottom of the hour. And before we get to all that, some words about the stock market, which had a rather bad day on Tuesday. I think everybody knows, it's curious, though, when I get phone calls from mainstream media asking me to talk about instability in the financial markets, I usually assume it's pretty close to a bottom in the markets. Well, I didn't get any calls. I got a call from Fox, but about something completely different. So by that measure, it's not close to a bottom yet, but that's an arcane and untested measure, so we'll see if that means anything. But anyway, back to the stock market, which had that bad day on Tuesday. The most widely followed index, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, fell 416 points. That's 3.3%. While the Dow isn't the best measure of the broad stock market, it consists of just 30 stocks out of thousands traded, and all of those 30 are very big, very rich companies. The Dow is still close enough for radio. And though that's nowhere near a record-setting daily decline in percentage terms, only 0.25% of the trading day since 1950 has seen bigger declines. The post-World War II champion is the great stock market crash of October 19, 1987, when the Dow fell almost 23%. That's seven times as much as we saw the other day. So Tuesday was a piker compared to that nasty October 1987. As it turned out, despite the fireworks, record-setting drop 17 years ago didn't really mean much in the larger scheme of things. The market recovered, and the broader economy kept expanding for another 3 years. Does this big, but not mega, drop really mean anything? The glib, but unfortunately accurate answer is it's too soon to tell. I don't want to take this as far as did Cho Enlai, who, when asked what he thought of the French Revolution, said that it was too early to tell. But I suspect we'll have the answer to this question, not the French Revolution, but the stock market, in a matter of months, maybe even weeks. Still, it's worth exploring what it could mean. Most of the time, the gyrations of the stock market mean almost nothing to those who aren't involved in the racket. Most people who own stocks don't own very many. Yes, about half of us have retirement plans that are heavily invested in the stock market, but those holdings are, in most cases, rather small. And the other half of us don't even have any retirement plans other than Social Security, and maybe the generosity of our children. But broad movements in the market can signal economic changes. The bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2000 was the overture to a long period of a crummy economy. And the takeoff of the bull market in August 1982 was an overture to the kind of economy we've experienced ever since, a boom for the rich and for corporate profits, but not all that much for everyone else. Back to the present. One potentially significant thing about Tuesday's swoon was that it began in China, with a 9% sell-off in the Shanghai Stock Exchange. And for those of us who grew up during the Cold War, the phrase Shanghai Stock Exchange still sounds a little strange, I gotta say. But this is a rather unusual development, since most of the time world markets take their lead from Wall Street. for China to set the tone marks the growing importance of that economy to the global economic and financial scene. Of special importance to the U.S. is the fact that, as I've pointed out here many times, we borrow enormous gobs of money from China every day the markets are open. We import stuff from them, thereby by sending them dollars, which the Chinese then recycle by buying American securities like treasury bonds. Additionally, all the money that U.S. and other foreign firms invest in China, so they can produce more stuff to send to us, injects more dollars into that country's economy, which are also recycled into our financial markets. So any sign of trouble in China, like a financial panic, would have to cause worry. What if they start needing that money at home instead of lending it to us? And a lot of that Chinese money has found its way into our mortgage market, which helped power the late housing boom and all the borrowing that went along with it. Wall Street has been flirting with the idea that the worst of our housing bust was over. But it's looking like that idea may be a rush to judgment. New house sales in the month of January were down almost 17% from December, a very, very sharp drop, the sharpest in more than a decade. And the bankers who lent money to poorer, riskier borrowers are reporting increasing signs of stress. Many of those borrowers are wildly overextended, and the only way that they could have kept paying their mortgages is if the housing boom continued. So that if the housing boom continued, they could either sell their house at a higher price or refinance the mortgage and just keep rolling it over. But when the price of houses are declining, you can't do that. You can't sell at a higher price, and you can't refinance your mortgage. So you're in trouble, and you have to service the debt out of current income, and a lot of people don't have the current income to do that. The National Association of Realtors, by the way, has reported now for the second consecutive year that 40% of first-time house buyers put no money down. It used to be you needed like a 20% down payment to buy a house. Well, that's not been the case for the last couple of years. 40% of first-time buyers, no money down at all. That's just imprudent, both for borrower and lender. So worries about what all this might mean for the broader economy deepened the anxieties on Wall Street on Tuesday. People would wonder what would happen, say, if all the lenders suddenly got hyper-cautious and cut way back on credit. Our economy would tank. We've been very, very dependent upon mortgage-related credit now for the last 5 years. Some $2 trillion of money borrowed against rising house values that were then spent by consumers. If that flow stops, then the U.S. economy is starved for resources. But then again, all this may not happen. Things could keep chugging along, not booming, but not busting either. The Federal Reserve could get nervous and start cutting interest rates and pumping money into the system, hoping that this might stimulate the economy back into some semblance of a boom. It's easy to scoff at that, but it's worked many times in the past, which is why I have to say again, it's still too early to tell. Markets stabilized yesterday, had a bad morning this morning, but then staged a recovery in the afternoon. Maybe Tuesday was just a one-day panic of the sort that financial markets are prone to now and then. Maybe it was a prelude to some rough going. We shall see. And by the way, it's kind of interesting to see Alan Greenspan making noise, stealing some headlines from the current Fed chair, Ben Bernanke. Just as Bernanke was about to give his congressional testimony the other day, Greenspan stole some headlines by saying he thought a recession might happen later this year. The cynical interpretation of this might be that he's a kind of a fading memory, and he wants to keep earning those $150,000 of speech fees. So to do that sort of thing, you have to create a stir now and then, and maybe that's what Greenspan was up to. But it's kind of ungracious to try to upstage your successor. He should be a little bit more like Robert Rubin, maybe, and just leave with grace and keep his mouth shut. Okay, let's take a little musical break, and then we'll be back to hear from Evelyn McDonald.
Through with you, so with one hand I rocked you, and with one heart I reached for you. I knew your youth was for the taking, fire on the metal plane, so I ran through the fields with the bats with their baby veins, faces burst from the barn in flames in the violet, violent sky, and I fell on my knees and pressed you against me. Your soul was like a network of spittle, like glass balls moving in like cold streams of logic and absurdities, like lightning attacks, and some will make it go crack. Some will make it go crack. The climb trade, for in
And that a bit from Patti Smith's song Kimberly from her 1975 debut album Horses. And it's addressed to her sister, but there are certainly some maternal feelings there. And it's also, I think, maybe the only example in popular music of an appropriation of a line of T.S. Eliot from The Wasteland. I think the bats with their baby vein faces in the violet night. Now let's listen to this interview recorded earlier today with Evelyn McDonald, who is a pop culture critic at the Miami Herald, was associated with the Village Voice for many years in the early 90s, and is the author of a book called Mama Rama, a memoir of sex, kids, and rock and roll, just published by DeCapo Books. Evelyn McDonald. So how does New York seem to you after all these years, Evelyn?
It seems much better than each time I've been here. You know, I left 6 months before 9/11, which so was pretty different to come back. And every time I've been back, you know, it's progressively better and better and better. It seems really, really good now. I mean, it just seems to have completely get back in its stride. You know, more commercial than ever. It seems that there's more chain stores, which is sad because I always come up here to find good shopping and I can't.
Do we still have our souls have been removed by all the uppification?
Yeah. But I mean, I love New York, and it's always good to be back.
And what about Miami? That's a really exotic territory to me. So give us the quickie interpretation of Miami.
Miami is really where North meets South. I mean, it's where, you know, Northerners come to, like, indulge in the Caribbean lifestyle and maybe, you know, get away from the American rat race. But it's where South Americans come to join the American dream and partake in. So you get such a weird mix of, like, you know, the McMansions and then, you know, people who are trying to have, like, a hippie lifestyle. And then just construction everywhere. The skyline is nothing but cranes, construction cranes. I mean, it's somewhat of a false boom, which the bottom is starting to fall out of.
Yeah, I have a friend who's actually a real estate banker down there, and he says it's all falling apart. And the friends who've made condos haven't had offers made in a year, so it's not going so good for them. But and what's it like working in a newspaper after all these years of being in all publications and such?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, I like being around people who are doing really great investigative reporting, and the Herald ran an amazing series last year about a low-income housing scandal where the county, Miami-Dade County, gave all this money to developers who basically built themselves homes with it and destroyed low-income housing and never rebuilt it. So it's really great to be around, like, that kind of journalism, which, you know, I was working for Interview and stuff right before I left New York. We were not getting that. You know, newspapers are in a really hard time right now, and they really struggling to figure out how to adjust to the digital age. And, you know, they're going to sink or swim.
So they have you blogging as part of your reporting duties?
They do now have me blogging as part of my reporting duties.
You also participated, though, in a investigative series about the Miami Police hip-hop division. Tell us about that.
That was a very wild story. That was something that people had been, you know, had been bandied about. There had been stories around it that this existed here in New York, and it sort of fell into my lap in Miami that I got an email from a cop completely telling me that they were doing this and asking me for the address of a local rap label that I'd written about. And so, you know, we found out they'd been coming to New York and training with the New York cops. You know, basically they were trying to educate themselves about hip-hop. Unfortunately, I don't think, which you know, I think there are, that could be okay. Unfortunately, I don't think they always got the right lessons. Some of the things they said to us felt very racist and very uninformed. And they, you know, they came here and they got, like, this binder of information of all these different rappers that had rap sheets, you know, had arrest records. And we saw that, which was pretty amazing to sort of see, like, a smoking gun in the office of some cops who didn't really realize that the one thing they didn't learn was that they weren't supposed to talk to the press. and, you know, when the story came out, it was a huge scandal, and there was like local political hearings about it, and Chief of Police John Timoney, you know, tried to deny it all. Meanwhile, the Chief of Miami Beach Police was like, "Yeah, we've got the bindery, you know, here it is. We got it from New York. Blame them." And everybody, all the police departments were blaming each other. It was kind of amusing.
Did it get picked up here that the NYPD was investigating hip hoppers?
You know, it got picked up some, but not a lot. It was kind of weird. I always had this feeling that the New York media felt that they got a little scooped and didn't, you know, got scooped by Miami of all places and felt like people didn't pick it up the way they should. There's been several documentaries made that I wrote this story with another reporter, Nicole White, and Nicole and I have been interviewed for, and we were interviewed by the BBC, we were interviewed by the Australian, radio. It was definitely worldwide, and you know, I continue to get emails from, you know, people who've seen these documentaries and want to know more.
All right, if anybody's listening, that's a topic for investigation here. Well, let's turn to a subject that interests me greatly, since I, after many, many years of resisting it, had a kid. He's 14 months old today. The difficulty of being a parent while avoiding being assimilated to all the disciplines and compromises of bourgeois parenthood, it's a tough one. So let's start by beating up an easy target, David Brooks, who had a very stupid column last Sunday in the New York Times. He seems to think the whole enterprise is ridiculous, and I guess you should just surrender to convention, right? What did you think of Brooks's column?
Yeah, I thought that, you know, the Fitzgerald quote about the great American tradition of missing the point. the point isn't about that this is, you know, some kind of lifestyle we're trying to foist on our kids and, you know, that we're just like everybody else. It's about your worldview, and you want your kid to have your worldview, and you want him or her to, you know, help make the world the kind of place that you're hoping it's going to become for them. And, you know, you want to make the world the place you want it to be for them. And to me, you become more radicalized and more committed to whatever your agenda is. You don't sell out. You don't, like, give in because you have more of a stake in the future. You know, you want, and that it's just about...
I take global warming more personally than I used to.
Absolutely, totally. I mean, and war, I just, you know, I'm very concerned when you're raising a young boy. And, I mean, unfortunately, you know, boys are more likely to be going off to war than girls. And, you know, it's very, very scary to think about what, you know, what is he going to face. Of course, my son happens to love war. I don't know how that happened, but...
It's a phase they all go through. So did I when I was one. I want to return to the gendering business in a bit, but you, first let's do a little bit of your personal history. Your introduction to parenthood was not an easy one, necessarily. You took up with a guy who already had some kids. So what's it like being introduced to parenthood through someone else's children?
It's very, very hard. I mean, I suppose in a way, you know, I hate to say it, you know, they were somewhat practiced and, you know, which certainly wasn't intended or whatever. Unfortunately, they, you know, I learned through them. And, you know, I'm sure that was as hard for them as it was for me. Their mom is still alive, but she's not active in their lives. So, you know, overall, it was a good thing that I came into their lives. And I think, you know, they say that, and they're wonderful, and they love me, and they love the book. But, you know, it was a very hard learning curve for all of us. The great thing was that I almost came in as much, and what I had to learn to do was come in as a big sister and come in as a friend and not as an authority figure. And that was a lot of fun, getting to, like, take them to, you know, concerts, which they had never been to because they lived in a small town. They didn't even live in a town. They lived in the middle of nowhere in Michigan. So... getting to expose them to that and getting, you know, they moved here to New York, and which was just, I'm sure, so hard for them. But, you know, and then they moved to Miami, and ultimately they're so happy, you know, that they're not still in the middle of nowhere. But getting to, I can't wait to, my son's coming in tonight. I can't wait to show Cole New York, and, you know, it's great. I was coming up with this thing today. It's what I'm calling the triple X approach to parenting, which is exposure, experience, an example. And, you know, that's the main thing, you know, don't lecture, just, like, show them the world and try to be a good example. So.
Your test is also complicated by the fact that you and your now husband come from extremely different worlds. He comes from, you know, he's a manual worker from rural Michigan. You're an urban bohemian. That must have really complicated the child-rearing issues as well, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we still have culture clashes. Although, I mean, I did grow up in the Midwest and had always spent my summers in rural Michigan and you know, had my foot in that. And he had also spent some time in cities and had traveled quite a bit and, you know, was interested in the world, is interested in the world at large. So, you know, we you know, could connect. But it's been hard, but he really helps pull me out of falling into the trap of middle-class parenting. You know, he'll really, he will be like, oh, you're just... He calls education at school is just indoctrinating them into the middle class, and you know, in a lot of ways, that's true. And you know, he helps remind me that it's not all about academics, and you know, that getting that kind of street experience or world experience is really what's important. And
one of the things that shocked me on becoming a parent is that the advice industry, both professional and even amateur, you can't walk down the street without somebody giving you advice about raising your kid.
Right. I mean,
how does one, you know, and it was someone, you know, like you or me with strong views about the world and how it should be, how do you sort all that out?
To a certain degree, because I was so unprepared, although, you know, I practiced with the girls, I mean, I still was pretty unprepared to have a baby. I had not had a lot of exposure to kids. I didn't have younger brothers or sisters. I didn't have nieces or nephews. I didn't grow up around a big family or anything. Not that many of my friends were having kids yet. Now that's starting to happen more. So I didn't mind getting advice and I picked through it. And, you know, you can usually tell what's good advice and what's not. I mean, to me, there's a sort of, this is very, you know, alternative approaches to parenting, you know, very wholesome, organic, whatever, which is really great. But a lot of that, I just like, I couldn't go that far. You know, I give my kid milk and, you know, it's not always organic and he seems to be okay, you know.
Who would have known there is so much written and discussed in the theory and practice of sleep, too? I never would have imagined that.
Right.
I'm speaking with Evelyn McDonald, who is a pop culture critic at the Miami Herald and author of the book Mamarama, just out from DeCapo Press. What about the issue of someone who is has an image or self-image of being a bohemian, a rebel, a nonconformist, being placed in this role of being a model, an authority,
right,
a figure of discipline? How do you reconcile that?
Right. It's hard, you know, when I find myself saying things like, you know, eat your vegetables, you know, I'm just like, oh, God, you know, what is that? How low am I sunk? But, you know, it's important for Cole to eat his vegetables. So you have to, I guess you have to try to figure out ways to make it fun and not to just become like a drone in it all and not just fall into traps of following rules because you think you're supposed to have the rules because that's what parenting is. You know, I don't think we have to, like, reinvent the wheel, but you know, I do think we have to sort of figure out how the wheel works for us and you know, maybe get a hybrid or something. There's a line in the book that, you know, it's one thing to be a bad girl, it's another thing to be a bad mom. Just the judgments that are placed upon you as a mother in particular, I mean as a parent in general, but I think, you know, moms in particular, you do something wrong and, you know, the world's just going to come down on you. And, you know, and it's, to a certain degree, there's a justification to that. However, I think that we tend to be, you know, just because I went to concerts when I was pregnant, I don't really think I was damaging the fetus, you know, which I've had people say, you know.
Yeah, well, people are full of advice like that, but also it's a way of getting them used to noise and maybe, you know, forming musical taste, who knows.
Right.
I was amazed to learn from your book that Maureen Tucker, who is the drummer in the classic early Velvet Underground albums, she played drums on songs like Venus and Furs and Heroin,
right,
doesn't want her kid to watch MTV because it's too sexy. So you have this situation sometimes where the rebels become hyper-disciplinarians.
Look at Madonna. I mean, she's like, you know, I just read something where she was like, I'm not letting my daughter date till she's 18. I mean, what is that? I mean, to me, that's ridiculous. To me, it's like, why would you do to your kids everything wrong that was done to you? And I do see that happening a lot, that some of the parents who were the most rebellious of kids don't want their kids to do anything that they did. And I'm like, look, you survived it. Your kid's hopefully going to survive it, probably. You know, you can't, I just don't think you can, you know, I'm not going to be a Nazi to my kid. My husband is really good on this stuff. I mean, I think he's sometimes too lax with his daughters, but he's letting them find their way in the world. I would give them a little more guidance if I were the one making the decisions, but when you're a step parent, you don't get to make the decisions. You have to go with the decisions that are made. And
if you want to be a rebel, you have to have something to rebel against.
There you go. Right.
You have a nice passage about rejecting the formula about balancing work and family. You're not a fulcrum. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I know. I like to think of it as more of a roller coaster ride, and this is the Mama-rama concept, that it's about integrating parenting, family into your life, and not about like that there's two sides and you have to somehow balance yourself between the middle of them, and which just seems, you know, probably impossible, and why, you know, women are, you know, constantly stressed out. And I mean, being on a roller coaster is stressful too. And I've always thought I like to be an adventurer, and that having kids are part of the adventure. And of course, you don't necessarily take the same risks. You're not going to risk your children in maybe the same way that you would, you know, if you were single. I won't, you know, when we go out on our boat, we, you know, hopefully we're not going to go out in bad weather or whatever that we might have before. But the kids are part of the adventure, and you want them to have the same spirit that you have. And it's not about like, okay, then the kid's over here and the adventure is over here, and somehow they're separate, and I, you know, alternate between the two. You know, it's all the same.
And what about the challenge to a feminist of raising a boy in this world?
Very, very hard. As I said before, my son is very into war, which, you know, I mean, if he could just pick something that, you know, I'm very against, he did it, you know, and maybe it's his chance to rebel at three already. I mean, mostly it's because, you know, we've let him watch TV, and he's, you know, his father loves, from an early age, loved to watch, like, how, you know, Westerns with him, and, you know, it's exciting. I mean, there is something, my son is a very typical boy, and I have a lot of deciding over how much of that was nature and how much of that is nurture. There's so much stuff in our culture right now that our culture is very gendered, and that people really, you know, we have really hyper-masculine and hyper-feminine images out there, and that boys and girls are buying into them in a way that I don't, you know, growing up in the 70s, I feel like there was more positive, you know, androgynous tomboy role models, whatever. I don't feel like that's supported in nurture. And for boys, that it was, you know, there was the Alan Alda, you know, sensitive male thing. And you know, and certainly being in Miami and being around, you know, more of a Latin culture also, I feel like there's a certain innate sexism and machismo that's kind of just ambient, that they just suck up like little sponges. We hand the girls the dolls, and we hand the boy the swords, and we applaud, and they go, oh, okay, this is what we're supposed to do. And, you know, and maybe it's appealing to their biology, maybe it's not. I mean, my brother and I, you know, I was a tomboy, and he stayed at home, you know, and, you know, we weren't that odd.
Before Ivan was born, I sort of wanted a girl, but now that I've seen some girls, the pressures on them now are terrible. I mean, this princess thing is insane. I had no idea of the prevalence of this princess madness. Where does that come from, and what do you make of it?
I just think that I think it's the ultimate backlash result, pop culture thing, of in the guise of a certain kind of empowerment. I mean, princesses do have a certain power, but it's just so circumscribed. But I think there's this culture pretends that it's rewarding girls and giving them this positive image of being princesses. But princesses are so objectified. I say, you know, go for the queen, be the queen. You know, the queen is the real ruler. That's where it's at. I just talked about this in the book, that there was this kind of devolution from Riot Girl, which was totally about empowering young women and girls and taking back, girlhood, and that be, then became Spice Girls and girl power. And I mean, you could just see the way corporate culture took this underground grassroots feminist idea, and you know, now it's princesses, which is just so far from what it was. I mean, yeah, there was a thing in Riot Girl, you know, there was a thing about like taking pretty frilly images, but you punked them up and you know, you recreated them, you know. That's not what's happening now.
So are there any...
No, there is a really cool line of Bratz punk dolls that is actually very cool. And actually, my neighbor, who was totally... He was seven, little girl, my son's best friend, who was very into princesses, is now totally into the Bratz punk thing. And I really think it's like been this positive development for her. You know, I think it's like a much better role model, you know.
I think that's a good optimistic note to close on.
And that was Evelyn McDonald, who is a pop culture critic at the Miami Herald and author of the book Mama Rama, a memoir of sex, kids, and rock and roll, just published by DeCapo Books. And Evelyn McDonald will be at the Bowery Poetry Club this Saturday afternoon, March 3 at 2 p.m. The Bowery Poetry Club is at 308 Bowery in Manhattan. Let's take a station break, and we'll be back.
New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
On WBAI 99.5 FM, the Caldwell Chronicle is on the air. I'm Earl Caldwell. Tune in for our broadcast every Friday, 3 to 5 p.m., right here on listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City.
And as the man said, this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial, and also on the web at WBAI.org. And, we're all archived and streamed and everything, so check out the website. Let's take a little musical break, and we will be back to speak with Omar Lizardo.
Express with care, go on, draw them superheroes with the curly hair. You my daughter, my love, more than kin to me. This for you and the woman that you finna be. Tell that boy he's wrong, girls are strong. Next time at show and tell, play a Mars song. Tell your teacher I said princesses are evil. How they got all their money was they kill people. If somebody hit you, hit them back. Then negotiate a peace contract. Life is a challenge and you gotta team up. If you play house, pretend that the man clean up. You too busy with the other things you gotta do. When you start something, now remember, follow through. Later on, you gon' blossom like a lotus. You'll get in the boys, and the boys gon' notice. It don't matter who you do it with. Just remember when I tell you, baby, you the sh**. Handshakes are promises. Lies can spoil it. Words should be bound and sealed.
And Boots Riley and the Coup, with a few words about princesses. He doesn't think very much of them, and I don't either. And we're back, and now joined in the line by Omar Lizardo, who is a professor of sociology at Notre Dame. Welcome to WBAI.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So there is a common thesis floating around, and I think it's popular with many people around this radio station, that the world is being poisoned by American cultural products. Hollywood and associated industries create a lot of crap and shove it down the throats of unwilling victims around the world and destroy their local cultures. You don't agree with that, do you?
No. There's a lot of reasons to disagree with that. One is that particular theory was first not developed to explain globalization, but it was first developed to explain within national societies, what would happen if giant cultural industries rose and mass-produced culture went all the way back in the 1930s and 1940s. And what a lot of sociologists found was that, I mean, that particular theory didn't explain what happened within nations. In other words, as Hollywood grew, as the music industry grew after the 1950s, we didn't see an end to art, an end to folk culture. What actually happened was that the arts and folk culture actually grew through the 1960s and 1970s within the U.S. and also in Europe. And then I think what happened after that was that people said, the theory maybe didn't work within nations. Now we're going to try to blow it up to explain what's happening at the global level. And what they did was that they just took the old ideas that kind of didn't work to explain the American experience, and they kind of say, well, maybe it works. You know, if we take the U.S. and then we take the poor countries of the world as kind of the victims of this drama. And I mean, what I've been doing in my recent research is trying to show that just for the very same reasons that the idea didn't work to explain national societies, it doesn't seem to be working also to explain what's happening at the global level.
Now, the politics of both this mass culture thesis, which you know identified with the Frankfurt School prominently, and also the cultural imperialism thesis, they live on both sides of the political spectrum. You have a kind of radical critique of it, which is very anti-imperialist and anti-American. Mm-hmm. But also there's a kind of conservative version of this,
right.
Which is, you know, much favors the local, the traditional, and looks to Hollywood as destroying morals and local culture. What do you make of that, the fact that left and right sort of can have a sort of common point of view on culture, mass culture?
That's certainly an interesting thing. So as you mentioned, it began, at least in the U.S., it began as a Marxist kind of inspired thing, kind of German emigres come to the U.S. and they move to L.A. and the kind of culture shock from Viennese intellectual life into Hollywood. And it develops initially as a kind of left-wing critique of the American culture industry, but it definitely is also taken up by conservatives. And I think, I mean, for the most part, what they have in common is that it's an intellectual critique, I think. So it really begins as both as a left and right intellectual critique of mass culture and there's an element of definitely an element of disconnect from what the populace is connects to, but there's also I think that's kind of what that commonality across political lines comes from, the fact that it's mostly kind of a literary and intellectual thing. It's probably one of the few issues in which you can get that kind of agreement across kind of radical political lines.
And I should say, you have a paper, Globalization and Cultural Sociological Perspective, which can be found on the web, and I'll try to tell people where to find it at the end of this segment. And also, I'll include it in the web archive of this radio show. I'll include a link to the paper, so anybody who wants to read it can do it themselves. You, in the paper, describe, although you don't go into much detail about this, but you say that people who study the way people consume culture say that there is just no empirical basis to this kind of, you know, ram it down their throats argument.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't develop in the paper, but could you talk a little about it a little bit here? How do people consume mass popular culture that runs against the common perspective?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that has to be differentiated, and I think a lot of the kind of the global media imperialism theorists usually point to kind of the large-scale structural organization of multinational popular culture industries, so that what you do find is high levels of concentration, the majority of it is produced in the West, and et cetera. And from that, then they draw an implication that then if you were to just go down to the ground and see how it is consumed, that it's consumed in a very passive way, that American ideas or Western ideas are kind of directly imbibed by the non-Western populations and kind of, you know, indiscriminately either believed or just simply transferred. Some people in media studies have to call this kind of the hypodermic model, like some kind of an injection, you know, of Western culture into non-Western populations. And this began to be criticized at an empirical level by various people, in particular in the anthropological tradition of ethnography, which is kind of a little different in that, you know, usually you go out and see what's really happening, you know. Are people kind of really, you know, just kind of imbibing American culture and really kind of uncritically accepting Western values and Western customs? And what they found was that yes, there is some consumption of American popular culture. In some places, a lot of the culture is in fact imported, even though that varies across media, so music is less likely to be imported than television, et cetera. But what they found, even for the case of music and film, was that there wasn't an uncritical acceptance of American values. The people did have some agency when it came to what they consume and how they consume it, how they consumed it, and what they got out of it. And in many cases, the particular cultural products were that might have had some Reagan era inspired pro consumerist message built into it was interpreted in radical different ways that kind of belied, that or sometimes contradicted that. And that, in many ways, there's also some segments of American popular culture that had that were interpreted as having meanings that actually served to empower people to kind of question the system and kind of question kind of power structures in their own societies.
Could you give, what do you mean by that?
One example, for instance, that comes out of music is kind of the cross-national spread of rap music that kind of in the American context had lots of messages that were kind of politically charged and had a particular meaning in where it developed, but then when it's consumed in other societies, it's kind of retooled and readapted for certain local things. So one example that I mentioned in my paper is certain Palestinian youth consuming rap, but thinking of it in their own terms and in their own struggles, not necessarily the kind of the black and white struggle in the U.S., but a different struggle over there. So it definitely, those kind of observations belie that the consumption of foreign culture kind of leads to kind of passivity and political impotence, and what you find is sometimes that's the opposite.
Speaking with Omar Lozada, who is a sociologist in the teaches at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. You also speak of culture, popular culture, as a kind of lubricant or prop to conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a bit.
Yeah. That's one of the extensions that I draw. For a lot of the research that has been done, at least in the West, for the most part, kind of the sociological research. Came up on this, the insight that for the most part, and also in contrast to this kind of the traditional Frankfurt School inspired criticism that, what mass culture will create a society of people that are all disconnected, kind of all watching television, that was kind of the mass society. Everybody is kind of fragmented and disconnected, and as they're enthralled and destroys communities, et cetera. What a lot of observation shows is, in fact, that for the most part, when people get together and people do get together and people do continue to have connections, that the primary subject of conversation is popular culture. So that as opposed to actually leading to fragmentation and social disconnection, what most survey research shows is that the more culture you consume, both popular and traditionally considered high arts culture, the more friends you have, the more social interaction you have. So that, in fact, the people that are that are socially isolated are also the people that are kind of culturally isolated, that either just watch TV or just do nothing at all. And I think so that goes with the observation that, for the most part, culture and the mass media culture has become kind of the primary kind of lubricant of interaction and conversation. And, of course, most of us can think of examples, but people do talk about television, do talk about the Oscars and about movies, and that's kind of, if it wasn't for that, there will be, in fact, for many people, kind of very, very, very little reason to actually, get together, or the conversations will be kind of very awkward and not there, in fact. So.
And I think a lot of those conversations are about making fun of this stuff, not just
that's right. Yeah.
treating
yeah.
it adoringly.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you also, in the paper, you're trying to put together some kind of theoretical framework for understanding
mm-hmm.
the flow of culture around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Just take one of the hypotheses of the media imperialism, cultural imperialism thesis would be that the poorer country is, the more likely it's to be penetrated
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
it has fewer of its own resources to defend itself against, the artillery barrage of cheap cultural commodities coming in from Hollywood. How does that comport with the empirical work you've done?
So part of the work that I've done, it's once again, it's drawing on some of the kind of more observational anthropological work and media studies. So, but more of what I'm doing is kind of using kind of statistical databases that have been put together by organizations like UNESCO and Cultural Division, et cetera, and trying to see whether, you know, the kind of cultural flows that we observe that occur across countries kind of conform to this idea that most that is an asymmetric flow going from kind of highly developed societies towards low development societies, and kind of trying to see whether that is the case. And what we find is that that is in fact not the case. That that in fact the social the global distribution of culture actually mirrors the national distribution of kind of culture consumption. So in national societies, the people that are the most culturally active are the most highly educated and segments of the upper middle class, and the people that are least culturally active are kind of the poor and et cetera. So what you find across societies is kind of the same thing. If you measure cultural activity by things like cultural imports and even levels of penetration of foreign culture, what you find is that the least developed societies are in fact the most culturally isolated from global flows, and that most of what is correct about the media imperialism thesis is that most culture is in fact produced in the West. What they fail to mention is that most culture is also most global culture is also consumed by Western countries. In other words, so most of our biggest export partners are not it's not Africa and Latin America. It's in fact European countries and Japan. So that there's definitely a flow of American culture, but that is mostly flowing across first world societies, and that what you find is kind of this system that in a way highly connected as of cultural flows across economically advantaged societies and kind of very weak cultural flows going across, so that the third world societies are mostly kind of isolated in this sense. And what you also find, of course, is that the U.S. is not only one of the primary exporters of global culture, it's also one of the primary importers of global culture, which is also an observation that I think kind of conform well to this idea that the U.S. just really sends a culture to other countries but really doesn't receive. But in fact, the U.S. is one of the primary consumers. The American population is one of the primary consumers of foreign culture.
Well, that actually kind of surprised me because, you know, I think of the U.S. in many ways as a very provincial country.
Mm-hmm,
We produce lots of cultural products and export them, but most of the music we listen to is of American production, and most of the films that Americans watch are of American production. So where is all this importing happening?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think the U.S. is distinctive in that it's one thing that you have to differentiate is kind of absolute levels of importing culture versus kind of, you know, per capita or by population. So the U.S. is culturally isolated because it consumes. If you go by absolute rates, yes, it imports a lot of culture. But if you just then break it down by per capita, then it's kind of culturally isolated. But it's really the reason for that is not necessarily because Americans don't consume culture, but it's, as you mentioned, the domestic culture production industry is so dominant in the U.S. that the Americans end up consuming a lot of their own culture. But still, it does have rates of cultural importation that are comparable to some countries in Europe. Of course, European societies are smaller, so if you just look at per capita, then it seems like Sweden, for instance, is more globally connected than the U.S. But I would definitely bet that if you were to then just simply kind of compare within the U.S. More urban upper middle class segments of the population. I would definitely bet that they are as avid as consumers of foreign culture as any European or Japanese person of the same range. So in a certain sense, the U.S. is certainly provincial or relatively provincial, but that's I think it's connected to the fact that the domestic culture industries are so dominant. But within certain kind of class strata, I think that the U.S. is definitely it has comparable levels of consumption of foreign culture and connection to global culture than other societies. I think the most globally connected societies that you find, the ones that import the most foreign culture, are in fact European societies. They import lots of U.S. culture, but they also import lots of other European culture. Both in film, you see that, and in music. So that the most globalized societies are also the societies that import the most global culture. And if you measure globalization by either trade or connection to the internet and things like that, So definitely, if you just take, you know, it's just a simple correlation between something like national income and proportion of culture that is foreign, you find a positive correlation, not a negative correlation.
So yeah, the richer the country, the more likely it is to import culture. Of course, the U.S. is a bit of an outlier in that, importing less culture than others,
and Japan
very
to
rich.
Extent.
And Japan, to some extent. Uh-huh. Well, they have a language problem, since almost nobody else in the world speaks any Japanese. But I would suspect also we have a lot of immigrant communities in the U.S. that import lots of culture from their homelands that
right.
don't really show up in the statistics. So we may be underestimating our cosmopolitanism.
That's right.
But you also write about, I think a prediction of a cultural imperialism thesis would be that imports of Hollywood films would destroy a domestic film production industry. Certainly a French cultural policy is based on that assumption.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't appear to be true, does it?
Yes, and that's a part of the paper that uses some statistical methods to try to determine whether, you know, if you import a certain amount of films at time one, are we going to observe a deterioration of the of domestic film production at time two? And what we find is that there is in fact no real influence, and if you find it's just a weak positive influence, so that's definitely a clear indication that there's something awry with the kind of the story or the mechanism that the mass, either the media imperialism or which is really a version of the mass culture thesis, is telling us that if a country imports foreign culture, it will destroy, or populations will stop caring about, or will just flock to the American cultural goods, cultural offerings, and will stop patronizing their own culture. What we find is that that's not the case, and in fact, both local culture and American culture can coexist, and one doesn't necessarily drive the other out. And once again, at least for this is definitely going to be the case for the richer societies of the world, definitely. But what we find is, once again, at least in the aggregate, you know, for a sample of world countries, that there is no negative influence, at least. And then, in fact, that, you know, also that one thing that I find is that as societies that produce more domestic culture are also more likely to import. So that you find is this kind of unexpected positive connection between domestic culture production and foreign imports. So what appears to be, there's a lot of economists talk about synergies between products and things like that, and what appears to be going on is definitely much more a synergy rather than a competitive effect, which is what most people assume.
So, in fact, the imports may just expand the market for cultural products in general and not replace them. I think you could do a version of the cultural imperialism thesis, which is that as people and countries get richer, they aspire to be more like Americans or you know, more like rich Westerners. So they throw over their own native cultures and embrace the imports. And there's a loss of diversity, and also there's something kind of sad about that kind of rejection of your own. Now, what do you think of that?
There's a lot of things there. What certainly does not appear to be the case is the diversity argument. I mean, once again, the diversity argument is usually made. It usually works somewhat well, you know, if you talk about Hollywood film. But if you talk about world music, for instance, the diversity argument does not work at all, because with the trends that we observe. And once again, these are statistics collected by UNESCO, which is an organization that definitely does not have any kind of political bent towards either one side or another. It probably have a political bent towards the mass culture side. What the statistics show, for instance, is that domestic production of music has actually increased through the last decade. And of course, the last decade is also the decade that has seen the most the highest increases in terms of foreign music exports. What appears to be the case, at least, is that is definitely that, at least in the case of music, the diversity has increased. Global cultural diversity has increased. There's more music produced today in the world than ever in all countries in the world. This is of course occurring simultaneously as there's more cultural flows going one way or the other than ever before. So definitely, globalization, at least in this particular case, has not led to homogenization. If by that you mean that the world today is more dominated by American British music than before. In fact, what you find is the opposite. That in terms of market share, there's definitely more of an equalization that has been occurring. And this has had a lot to do with certain East Asian countries coming online, developing domestic culture industries to serve their own population to a larger extent. India, in particular, and China, more recently, as it has incorporated Hong Kong politically, et cetera. That has had a big impact. Certain places in Latin America have developed fairly competitive domestic and regional music industries. So what appears to be happening is kind of a regionalization of cultural production rather than this homogenization.
All right, well, I'm afraid we have to bring it to a close there. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Omar Lazarda, who is a professor of sociology at Notre Dame, and you can find this paper. I think the easiest way is just to Google his name, and it'll come up very, very close to the top. Omar, O-M-A-R, Lazardo, L-I-Z-A-R-D-O, Globalization and Culture, a Sociological Perspective. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I won't be here next week because of International Women's Day, which is taking 2 days next week. And I will be back the week after. And let's go out with an example of this kind of cultural hybridization. This is Talvin Singh, who is of Indian ancestry, Indian-trained classical musician, who also does electronica and produces his stuff in Britain. So let's listen to a little bit of this cultural hybridization. Till 2 weeks. Bye.